May it please the court, good morning. I'd like to start off the oral argument this morning addressing a couple of aspects of the special appearance issue. The first is going to be the due order of hearing requirement of Texas Rule of Civil Procedure 120A2. And then I'd like to follow up with pointing to the court to what I would submit are three examples of general appearances by Mr. Hoskins prior to the hearing on his special exceptions, as well as the ruling, special appearance, as well as the ruling on his special appearance. With regard to the first aspect, Rule 120A2 specifically provides that the first thing that you have to hear once a special appearance has been filed is a special appearance. If you hear anything before then, you've made a general appearance and you've waived it. Now, the exception to this is a string of cases starting with Austin Dawson going through Trejo, which provide that if the other proceedings that you initiate in advance of the actual hearing on the special appearance have to do with the personal jurisdiction issue, for example, discovery relating to the personal jurisdiction issue, even motions for continuance of other hearings in order to conduct discovery on the personal jurisdiction issue, those do not constitute waivers. However, what I'd like to do is point the court to the original special exceptions that were filed in this case. The original special exceptions were pointed to the original petition. The original petition was limited to breach of contract and quantum merit. The special exceptions argued, number one, that Mr. Hoskins, as well as the other defendants that had been named so far in the lawsuit, were not parties to the contract, and therefore there was no privity. That has nothing to do with personal jurisdiction. The second issue with regard to quantum merit was that there were no pleadings which talked about the value of services or materials that had been provided or accepted. Once again, that has nothing to do with personal jurisdiction. These special exceptions, at least those, had nothing to do with personal jurisdiction and respectfully constituted a waiver of the special appearance. What I'd like to do is point the court to what I think is a very important and...
Are you saying it was a waiver because of due order of pleading or due order of hearing?
That's a very good question. I'm saying it's a due order of hearing. That's a very good point, and I'm actually getting to that. It's I don't know if the court is aware of this case. None of the parties cited it, but it's this, and forgive my pronunciation, it's the Klingenschmidt case out of Dallas. Yes, Your Honor. That's exactly the case I was going to commend to the court and ask that the court look at. I think that's a very good point. I would take Klingenschmidt and go a step further, which the Dallas court didn't do. The Dallas court in that case acknowledged that there had been a hearing on special exceptions and then an amendment and then a motion to dismiss, just like this case. But the Dallas court didn't go so far as to say the hearing on those special exceptions constituted a waiver. I don't know why. I would contend to the court that it does. But regardless, even if we're going to just hold totally true to Klingenschmidt, we have the exact same situation here. We have a situation where Mr. Hoskins' counsel, when asked by the court, what do you want to proceed with first? I've got a motion to strike, I've got some special exceptions, and I've got a special appearance. What do you want to hear first? Mr. Hoskins' lawyer said, I want to hear the motion to strike first. Well, the motion to strike is a request for an adjudication on the merits. And what the Dallas court held in Klingenschmidt is that you can't do that. You can't ask for a determination on the merits, an adjudication on the merits, and still maintain your special appearance. You have to hear the special appearance first. And I think that goes right to the heart of the issue on this. I wanted to point out, though, that in regards to the supplemental special exceptions that were filed prior to the hearing, those not only do they not are they not limited to the issue of personal jurisdiction, but they go a step further. Those talked about how the claims that were unrelated to the breach of contract and quantum merit were barred by the economic loss rule, that you can't recover in both contract and tort. Again, nothing to do with personal jurisdiction. Then we have a request for the court to apply Chapter 21 of the Texas Business Organizations Code to the alter ego claims that had been alleged in the amended petition. Again, has nothing to do with personal jurisdiction. It's waiver upon waiver upon waiver. As Justice Walker has pointed out, then we go forward with a motion to strike, which is the same as a motion to dismiss. From what I can tell in the case law, the issue is a motion to dismiss goes to if you're trying to get the entire case dismissed. The motion to strike is what it's called if you're only going to certain claims and causes of action. In this particular case, we still have live claims pending. The court did not grant special exceptions or the motion to strike as to the breach of contract and quantum Merowick claims as to New Rock Group, Inc. So it's not a motion to dismiss, but it was a motion to strike, and those pleadings that we had were alleging against Mr. Hoskins have been stricken. It's an adjudication on the merits.
Say that's correct, that your position is correct on the due order of hearing and the motion to strike was a waiver of the special appearance. What's the remedy?
The remedy is, number one, a reversal on the special appearance and a remand to the trial court for trial. Against me.
I guess what I'm asking is, do we have to reach the merits then of the motion to strike?
Absolutely, Your Honor. You do, and it's a great question, and I'm going to answer it, but I think it's important to also note an inconsistent position taken by Mr. Hoskins. What Mr. Hoskins first says in his first issue is, no, I didn't waive my special appearance by arguing my special exceptions in my motion to strike because it all had to do with personal jurisdiction. Then he comes back at the end of his brief, the last page of his brief, and he says, by the way, court, you don't have pendant jurisdiction over the motion to strike and the special exceptions because they don't have anything to do with personal jurisdiction. Well, that's internally inconsistent. We obviously don't agree with that. We think that it did have to do with it, and here's why. Once the court granted the special appearance, the court did not have jurisdiction to do anything else. The court couldn't strike the pleadings as to Mr. Hoskins. All the court could do was dismiss the case as to Mr. Hoskins, and that was it. A court cannot grant an adjudication on the merits after it has granted a special exception. I'll actually point the court to a couple of sites for that. One is in the Attorney General versus Saylor case. The site for that is 871 Southwest 2nd, 257, with a jump page of 258. And then I also have the Geo Chevron Ortiz Ranch case, which is a memo opinion. It's a 2007 opinion. 2007 Westlaw. And the number is 671340. And what those cases say is that ruling on special exceptions, you can't go any further. You can't do an adjudication on the merits, which is exactly what the court did here. Both in the hearing and in the order, the court grants the special appearance and then goes on to strike the pleadings against Mr. Hoskins. And this rule makes sense. It really does, because if a court in Texas determines that it doesn't have jurisdiction over Mr. Hoskins and then proceeds to strike our claims against Mr. Hoskins, that's not fair, because if Texas doesn't have jurisdiction, then surely Georgia does. Mr. Hoskins concedes as much. That's where he lives. So we should be able to go sue him in Georgia, not Texas. But Texas can't, on one hand, say it doesn't have jurisdiction, and then on the other hand, strike our claims and make it where we can't go back and sue him in Georgia, if that's ultimately what we need to do. I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure I understand what you mean. The merits of the motion to strike?
Correct.
Well, I think that you... Oh, okay, I think I understand the question. My answer would be no, because if the court lacked jurisdiction to rule on the motion to strike, then it's void, and the court should just set that provision of the order aside as void, and that would not, you wouldn't have to reach the merits on that or get into any discussion like that. Would be my answer to that question. The court has anticipated a lot of where I was going to be going today. Another thing that I'd like to cover that I think is really important, which goes more to, I think, what Justice Walker was going to, is the issue of the special exceptions in the motion striking, specifically the claims of fraud and fraudulent inducement. I think that's a very important issue to talk about, because it avoids the situation where we get a reversal of the special appearance, and we don't have any adjudication as to the motion to strike. So here's what happened. We filed an original petition alleging claims for breach of contract and quantum Merowick. Special exceptions were filed. We amended to include tort-based claims with that. Ultimately, the court struck all of our tort-based claims. The problem is that we had also filed fraud and fraudulent inducement claims that it's undisputed were never specially accepted to. They were never brought up in special exceptions. They were never sustained. We were never given an opportunity to replead fraud and fraudulent inducement. so that regardless of anything else with regard to the motion to strike and the special exceptions, it was clearly error for the trial court to have stricken the fraud and fraudulent inducement claims. As the court is aware, the special exception procedure is very important. Number one, the petition is filed. Number two, special exceptions are filed. You aren't specific enough. You're not giving me fair notice, which is the standard of what it is that you're alleging. Then you got to get it heard. Then you have to have an order entered granting them. And then you have to give the plaintiff an opportunity to replead. Only after the plaintiff fails to replead, either at all or sufficiently, only then can the court strike the pleadings. Otherwise, it's a general demur, which Texas law doesn't allow, which is exactly what happened in this case. Mr. Hoskins never filed no party ever filed special exceptions as to fraud or fraudulent inducement, but the court struck him anyway. And that was obviously error. So no matter what the court does in terms of the motion to strike, that specific part of the order should unquestionably be reversed. Unless the court has any further questions for me, I think I'm done, but I'm more than happy to answer any. Oh, I'm sorry. I did want to say one more thing. I apologize. I do apologize. I think that this is really important and worth bringing up. I had said I was going to talk about general appearances. Under Dawson Austin and under the Klingenschmidt case, a party makes a general appearance when he requests affirmative relief inconsistent with an assertion that the trial court lacks jurisdiction. That's a general appearance. Well, we've already talked about the first one. It was the motion to strike. I would contend that that was a general appearance and therefore a waiver of the special appearance. But I think it's important to point out what I think are two more. I was looking at the motion for sanctions, and it really stood out to me that this is the prayer to their motion for sanctions, and I just want to read it aloud to the court. It's very short. Defendants pray that upon a final hearing hereof, this is page 45 of the supplemental clerk's record, the court order that plaintiff recover nothing of and from defendants, and award defendants their actual damages, attorney's fees, pre-judgment and post-judgment interest, all costs of court, and such further and other relief, et cetera, et cetera. The prayer to their motion for sanctions requests a take-nothing judgment against SBG. It requests damages for them. It requests attorney's fees for them. And it requests costs and interest. This is a general appearance. Mr. Hoskins is not contesting jury. He's asking the court to make an adjudication of the merits of this case and give him relief. It's a prayer to the motion for sanctions, but as this court knows, it doesn't matter what you call it. It matters what you're asking for. You can call it anything you want, but we rely on prayers for a reason. Prayers are important. Prayers say what you're really asking for. And in the motion for sanctions, that's what this prayer says. I want to point out the identical prayer is the prayer to the special appearance on page 15 of the clerk's record. Now, it's just an interesting point. I'm not sure really where we can go with it, but I think it's worth pointing out that the motion for sanctions with that prayer requesting that relief is still pending. It's still pending in the trial court. As we stand here today, this pleading asking for this relief on Mr. Hoskins' behalf is still pending. And if that's not a general appearance, then I don't know what is. Respectfully, it is. And so if there are no further questions, I will actually sit down now. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. May it please the court. this case is a little different, I think, than how my opposing counsel sort of put it out there. This case is a breach of contract case between SBG and New Rock Group, Inc. That's the way it should have been pled originally. Instead, they attached that original contract, the consulting agreement that says SBG and New Rock Group, Inc., and they didn't sue New Rock Group, Inc. They sued New Rock Development, Inc., an entity that they put into some of those addendums that were never signed by Robert Hoskins.
But all that doesn't really matter for the purposes of the special appearance, right?
And I agree. But it does matter when we get to some of these tort claims, because it sort of illustrates that there are no tort causes of action. This is a breach of contract case. The reason why the alter ego claims and the one loss rule are applicable, the reason they were made part of the special exceptions, is that the fiduciary shield doctrine prohibits personal jurisdiction over a representative of a business entity unless that person is the alter ego of that business entity, or unless that person, that representative, has committed an intentional tort or fraud in the state of Texas. So the one loss rule becomes important because without a tort cause of action, they have no jurisdiction personally over Mr. Hoskins. The way they pled it is immediately once they filed a breach of contract, and the documents and the record proves up, they said, well, we didn't even know of New Rock Group, Inc., the entity on the contract. They didn't even know of New Rock Group, Inc. Thanks for bringing it to my attention. I said, dismiss the wrong parties, add the right one. Take out all these other entities and put New Rock Group, Inc. in. And they said, well, thanks for bringing it to my attention. We'll add New Rock Group, Inc. We're not going to dismiss these other parties. They went on, the trial counsel said in his email to me, we named New Rock Development Group, Inc. and New Rock Development Texas and the other entities because they had similar sounding names to New Rock Development, the entity that didn't exist that they, I'm assuming in a typographical area, and put into those addendums. They did that. These things were drafted by SBG. They came up with this fictional entity. They were the ones who then went on to sue other entities because of similarly sounding names, and then they alleged Hoskins. Well, because we have to refute, if the plaintiff asserts causes of action, they have to allege sufficient allegations to bring the long arm statute into play. And so what they did is they said Robert Hoskins committed torts. They didn't allege, they labeled them fraud by non-disclosure, breach of fiduciary duty, but didn't say what representations did he make, what duty did he owe, what damages did you rely on. It's just a bare bones generic, you committed all these laundry list of torts. Well, now presumably the burden then shifts to Robert Hoskins to deny the torts or the basis of this jurisdiction, because the jurisdiction over Mr. Hoskins is not based on the contract claims, it's based on the tort claims. The fiduciary shield doctrine shields him from personal jurisdiction on the breach of contract claim. He signed it only in his capacity as president. Yes.
Let's move to how the due order of hearing either wasn't violated by the hearing of the motion to strike, or also how, well, let's do that one first.
Okay. The due order of hearing applies not to pleadings filed, but to relief granted. The fact that there's a motion for sanctions down there that hasn't been ruled on doesn't violate the due order of hearing. It's the relief granted.
I thought it was a hearing held.
Well, a hearing held, but the hearings were all held. The original hearing was in August 13th of 2010, and it was held on the special appearance, then subject to the special exceptions and subject there to whatever the other pleading was. And what the court did is they said, look, I'm going to grant the special exceptions, and I'll hold off on the special appearance because even the court recognized then, the trial court, that there weren't even allegations pled to sufficiently plead any tort causes of action to serve as a basis for jurisdiction.
But the motion to strike.
The motion for strike was filed.
Was filed, but
it wasn't heard first. There's a context there where he says, I was addressing the factual backgrounds leading up to it. The judge did not go and say, okay, I'm going to rule on the motion to strike. Now let's take up this motion.
I thought the judge said, which do you want to hear first? And he said the motion to strike.
I wanted to talk about why we got to here, but the judge did not rule separately. There wasn't.
But it's a due order of hearing, not a due order of ruling, isn't it?
It is, but it was an intertwined. There's not a way to say that. Just because I said I want to talk about that motion first, that he ruled on that motion first or addressed that. I mean, all the motions were there, and in fact, that was the last filed pleading. I don't think that violates it because it was all heard at the same time, it was all argued at the same time, and it was all ruled on at the same time.
You said you wanted to talk about it, or did you want to have that hearing?
I can't remember. He just said, it's in here, and I certainly don't mind looking. I don't have it right in front of me. But my recollection is, it says what it says. How do you want to take this up? And I may have said whatever I said. I don't dispute what's in the record. But the context of it was we were hearing all of these at the same time, and I don't know why I wanted to talk about the particular facts to that one first. The other issues raised by the appellant in here is the fraud and fraudulent inducement claims. Those were part of the special exceptions order because what they did is they filed that 2 days before the original hearing on the special exceptions. He says that we never filed special exceptions. It was never part of an order, and they'd never been given an opportunity to replead. That's not true. If you look at the special exceptions order, it says, and this was 2 days after they filed it, and it was brought up at the hearing, but they said, you have to replead every one of your causes of action separately against every defendant, and you have to assert factual evidence to support each element. The issue was, remember, this was a breach of contract case. Once they figured out that they had sued the wrong party, they added the right party, but they wanted to keep all these other entities that had never been a party of the contract. There's no evidence they provided any services to any of these other entities or Mr. Hoskins in his individual capacity.
See, even when you're talking about no evidence, that doesn't sound like a special appearance. I mean, we really don't care what evidence there is right now.
I understand. But what are the allegations? In order to establish personal jurisdiction, they have to show general jurisdiction, which means he has a continuous conduct or contact to the state in his personal capacity. They didn't allege that. So that you go to specific jurisdiction. Then they have to show that he has purposely availed himself by committing acts and taking actions in the state of Texas. But it's not enough to say that he flew to the state of Texas and traveled around the state of Texas if it was done in his capacity.
I think that the burden of proof that once they plead that the long arm statute applies for whatever reason, because a tort was committed or a contract was breached, then all the defendant has to do is come forward with an affidavit saying, I've never been to Texas, I don't do business in Texas. It really doesn't matter what their pleadings are, as long as I think the burden is on the defendant to come forward with that. And all this happened before anything was presented by the defendant like that.
Well, we did file an affidavit that said when he'd come to Texas, it was in his business capacity, that he hadn't owned real estate in Texas in 25 years, that he hasn't committed any torts in Texas. We did all of that. But that's the reason why you're allowed to conduct discovery, because establishing jurisdiction is a factual issue, whether you have established contacts with a state. That's why the courts allow you, and the rule specifically allows you, to conduct discovery before you have a hearing on the special appearance, and why even motions and orders having to do with the discovery for purposes of the special appearance do not violate the due order of hearings rule. That's what that... Well, the motion to strike, mind you, wasn't. The special exceptions were. The motion to strike, though, was...
Were what?
Were in order to determine...
The special exceptions were discovery?
No, they weren't discovery, but they were related to the issue of the special appearance. Because they've alleged these generic claims of torts, and they're saying, well, we've alleged he committed a tort in the state of Texas, Judge. That's an exception to the fiduciary shield doctrine. That's what it came down to. Judge, we alleged a tort. That's an exception to the fiduciary shield doctrine. But what tort? Well, but we alleged it. Well, what did you allege? Well, we said he...
What page of the card chart is out?
I have it right here. You want the order that told him what to do, or you want what he actually did in the Fourth Amended petition? Oh, that's case law, Your Honor, that says...
I'm aware of the case law, but you said that that was their position.
Oh, well, their position about that he committed the torts as the exception to the fiduciary...
They said it was an exception to the fiduciary shield, and I'm wondering where in the record they said that.
I'll have to go back and look at their actual response, but it was certainly their argument, because it can't be on the contract claims. Robert Hoskins never signed the contract in his personal capacity. There's no question that he only signed it in his capacity of president of New Rock Group, Inc., which is in good standing and has always been in good standing.
Well,
There's no other way to establish jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction over Robert Hoskins, if the only thing he did on the breach of contract is he signed the contract in his capacity as president. Because the motion to strike was a remedy premised on the special exceptions that they had refused to identify any factual allegations for the tort causes of action to support their claims of jurisdiction. They had refused to answer discovery with respect. I asked them in discovery, and they refused to answer any discovery about that. The motion to strike was a remedy that either they're not going to plead any, they're going to say generically he committed a tort, but not tell us anything that we can then use to refute.
Then why not just go ahead with your special hearing?
Well,
you're asking the trial court to use your word to give your client, which you say isn't properly before that trial court, a remedy. How is that not waiving your special hearing?
To me, it was all intertwined. We weren't addressing any motion specifically. He didn't make a ruling and then say, let's take up the next motions. We were talking about factually what was going, and what I wanted to do was to pick up with the special exceptions because that was how we got to here. We got to the second hearing because they failed to do what they were supposed to do with the first order, which was replete it so that we can get to the actual allegations about whether he actually does have committed a tort that would serve as a foundation. And I've just got a brief time. I want to address one other issue. He argues that we're trying to have our cake and eat it too, that we're saying that it's all the special exceptions are intertwined, but then we're saying you can't hear it on appeal because it's not an interlocutory order that can be reviewed. The issue is this. If I did waive the special appearance, then we did generally appear, and there was no reason why the court couldn't have granted the special exceptions. So the argument is, we either didn't waive it, and the special appearance is fine, or we did waive the special appearance, and the court was proper to have addressed the special exceptions and to have ordered the striking of the pleadings, which is not subject to an interlocutory order or to an interlocutory review. So if I did waive it, the court's special exceptions are proper. It's an abuse of discretion, but it also is not subject to interlocutory review. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, I have some questions.
Yes, Your Honor.
I know your time is about up, but I want to ask you some questions, and I hope that you'll indulge me if I didn't have time to answer. The only two orders are decisions rendered by order that I have in the briefing that was filed is on August 30th, 2010 order. It's on page 217 of the record, signed by Judge Lowe. And that's the first order in this case, isn't it?
Wait.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the second is an order signed by presiding Judge Farrar, and that's on page 580 of the record, and that's dated December 17th of 2010.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Those are the only two orders we're talking about on this appeal, I think.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe those are the only two orders in the case.
And you attached in your appellee's brief on a Exhibit D, which is entitled Defendant's Motion for Sanctions. Is that what you're referring to as a motion to strike?
No, Your Honor.
And so you didn't attach the motion to strike to your brief?
I didn't attach it to the brief. I believe it's in the clerk's record that was brought up on appeal.
I understand. I'm just looking at what's attached and what I'm reading.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Now, the special appearance under Rule 128 addressed only one entity, that being Hoskins individual.
That's correct.
And the motions for your special exceptions that were filed, did any of those special exceptions relate to the live pleading, which would have been forward, the amended, second amended petition plaintiffs.
Yes, Your Honor. We filed.
Fourth amended petition.
We filed a supplemental special exceptions after that original August. The hearing was August 13th, but maybe the order was signed August 30th.
Okay, well, I've asked you to look at just one thing in terms of factual allegations and factual activities that are apparent from the record, and you referred in your brief to the attachment to the plaintiff's original petition and looking at the actual language of what was a consulting agreement. And there are two addendums to that consulting agreement, one and number two, that are both signed by Mr. Hoskins as owner, and the owner in amendments one and two is shown to be New Rock Group, Inc.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So New Rock Group, Inc. was in fact signing, Mr. Hoskins, when he signed those, was signing the document that had one of the other companies on number one. It's SVG Development Services, LP. And on number two, it's SVG Development Services, LP. And they're listed at in the initial paragraph as owner in both of those addendums, and your client is signing on behalf of New Rock Group, Inc., owner. It doesn't say president under there. On those places where he's signing. So is he making a representation that he's representing or was signing an agreement on behalf of SVG Development Services, LP, when he signed those documents?
New Rock Group, Inc. is the proper party. They sued New Rock Development, Inc.
Look at the original petition where it's attached on page 15 of the court's record, the clerk's record, is attaching the piece of paper that's called the consulting agreement addendum number one. See that?
I do. I'm looking at it right now, Your Honor.
And so you see in the opening paragraph, it's SVG Development Services, LP. And it is New Rock Development, Inc. as the owner. And it's not New Rock Group, Inc. It's New Rock Development, Inc., which is one of the entities we're talking about that he was supposedly signing documents for. That was part of the allegations of misrepresentation. Mm-hmm. I'm just looking at what you're finding and doing.
What he signed was on behalf of New Rock Group, Inc. on the signature block.
See, that's on the signature block, and the signature block is on the section of the document that talks about it being New Rock Development, Inc. is the owner.
I understand, and it references the original consulting agreement that only talks about New Rock Group, Inc.
Well, if your client was intending to claim later that wasn't a proper entity, why did he sign this document as though it was?
He didn't draft it. The second thing is, I think he looked at the signature block and he saw the correct entity name and signed on behalf of the correct entity. He didn't catch the typo in the recital.
All right. Is there any evidence about that in the affidavit you say you filed?
I believe the affidavits say that there is no such entity as New Rock Development, Inc., and we've never taken the position that there was.
And so that contradicts with what he did in signing the signature block on a piece of paper that says that there's a conflict in his owner. One's top paragraph says New Rock Development, Inc. is owner, and the signature block says New Rock Group, Inc. is the owner.
Well, it makes reference to the contract. It doesn't say that if you look at the top sentence, Your Honor, it says this becomes an addendum. It's an addendum to and becomes part of the original agreement that was between SBG and New Rock Development, Inc. Well, there is no such contract. He's not saying that he's signing. They're just making reference to a contract that purportedly, by that first sentence, was between New Rock Development, Inc. and SBG. He doesn't anywhere in here say he is signing as owner or on behalf of New Rock Development.
I'm just looking at the piece of paper.
I am too, Your Honor, but if you look at where his Hoskins signatures are, he signs only where it says New Rock Group, Inc. by Robert Hoskins. That's the only owner on these addendums. Where it says New Rock Development, Your Honor, it's making reference, it's just referring to a separate document. It doesn't say that he's signing on behalf of New Rock Development. It's merely referencing a contract that this becomes part of. And that other contract that it becomes part of was signed by Mr. Hoskins as, I believe, it's right here, and I believe it says as president. Yeah, it does. It's page 14 of the clerk's record is the signature line. It says New Rock Group, Inc. by Robert Hoskins, president.
Thank you for answering my question, sir.
You're welcome.
Counsel, your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honor. I think the court's questions regarding the signature blocks on the addendums and what exactly was being represented in terms of Mr. Hoskins' capacity to enter into these agreements on behalf of certain entities goes right to the jurisdictional facts supporting the exercise of personal jurisdiction over Mr. Hoskins, regardless of what I believe is a very clear record of waiver here. In addition, to the jurisdictional fact that Mr. Hoskins was signing addendums purporting to be able to sign them on behalf of entities which the appellees have repeatedly taken position don't exist. The fourth amended petition alleges what I would purport to the court are clearly sufficient jurisdictional facts. If the court would look at the clerk's record on page 253, we have the beginning of the fourth amended petition's allegations against Mr. Hoskins. I think they're more than sufficient. But regardless, I think that the appellees have ignored what is a very important tenet of law in special appearances and personal jurisdiction. You're not just limited to the allegations in the pleading, but you also look to the allegations that are contained in the response to the special appearance. The case site for that is the Taraji case. It's 316 Southwest 3rd, 15 with a pinpoint site of 23. That case says you also look at the allegations and the response to the special appearance. In this particular case, we have number one, allegations that Mr. Hoskins traveled to Texas at least four times per year to discuss business with SBG, and that's on clerk's record page 46 and 67. And then in addition to that, we have facts that Mr. Hoskins fraudulently induced SBG to continue entering into further addendums while it wasn't being paid for addendums that it had already entered into based on Mr. Hoskins' representations that we were going to be paid, and we weren't paid. And as a result of his misrepresentations, we continued to enter into further addendums. And that's on clerk's record, page 68, 71, 74, and 76. So again, I think that the record reflects more than sufficient jurisdictional facts. I think the court also picked up on a very important distinction. Opposing counsel pointed out that the court did not necessarily rule on the special appearance after ruling on the motion to strike. It doesn't matter when the ruling was made. The touchstone issue is when the relief is requested. And if you will look at page 5 of the reporter's record, I don't think there's any question but that Mr. Hoskins' counsel was given the option with what to proceed with, and he chose to proceed with the motion to strike, and that's what was heard first. And that's the relief that was requested first, and that's the issue. And then I wanted to point out, in addition to the fact that he started with the motion to strike, he then goes on to explain on pages 12 and 13 of the reporter's record that Judge Lowy did not rule on the special appearance because he was hoping by ruling on the special exceptions he wouldn't have to rule on the special appearance. That's completely improper and contrary to the procedure that you're supposed to follow with regard to special appearances and determinations of personal jurisdiction. And then finally, with regard to the idea that if they're wrong, and if in fact Texas does have personal jurisdiction over Mr. Hoskins, then fine, go ahead and say that, but we still have all of our claims stricken against Mr. Hoskins. Again, we're ignoring the fact that after the trial court granted the motion to strike after granting the special appearance, which the trial court couldn't do. The trial court didn't have jurisdiction to do it. It's void. That part of the order striking the pleadings as to Mr. Hoskins is void. And as this court knows, not only can this court set aside a void order anytime it wants, but it has an obligation to do so. And so that's why we can't just reverse the portion of the special appearance and then remand with no claims against Mr. Hoskins. And if the court has any further questions, I'm happy to answer them.
I have a question about the relief that you were just mentioning. So is it your position then that the proper relief would be to either send it back for a hearing on the special appearance or say that there was a waiver and it constituted a general appearance, and then in either event set aside the relief striking without regard to the merits?
That would certainly be fine. I do think that the court would have jurisdiction because of, and let me say it this way. It's our position that the motion to strike, which was based on the special exceptions, is improper and incorrect substantively and on the merits. We think that we pled sufficient facts and met the fair notice standard. But the reason that the court can address the merits if the court so chooses is that part of the reason that the order striking the pleadings is erroneous is because of the trial court's ruling on the special exception, special appearance. That's the problem, and that's why I think the court can reach the merits if it wants to.
The special appearance is subject to an interlocutory appeal under 51014, and the order striking is not subject to any type of interlocutory appeal. So that's what I'm asking, is if the proper method would be just to reverse that without regards to the merits, to put everything back to the status quo, or if we have to reach the merits.
You don't. Let me be more respectful than that. Obviously, the court can do whatever it wants to do. You don't have to reach the merits. I want to make that very clear. I don't believe that you do. I think you set it aside and send it back and remand it. But the court could exercise jurisdiction, in my opinion, based on pendant jurisdiction because of its relationship to the special appearance. That's my only caveat beyond that. And that's all I'll say about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments here today. Your case is submitted, and you will be receiving an opinion from us in due course. You are free to leave. Do we have counsel for the 10:30 case here yet? Both counsel are here. Are you all ready to proceed, or do you need a break?